session number 20155, Reel 1.
Harry Keeble, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Probably by Bow, in Middlesex, London.
Which year was this?
19th of June, 1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Bromley by Bow?
In the main, yes, because when I was about 5 years old, I actually was put in a children's home, which was called the Poplars in just outside Brentwood at Hutton. And I was put there, of course, because of the scarcity of places to live. I had a brother and two sisters, and my two sisters were the only people taken by my parents to live in two rooms. And therefore, for a while, I was in this home with my elder brother, who's 7 years older than me. He's dead now, of course. And he went, I was there for a while, and then I had a gnat bite on my ankle, my left ankle, which was unfortunately pricked with a needle which hadn't been sterilised. And unfortunately then it went septic, and I later on had to have a bone removed from my foot, which it means I have one foot smaller than the other. So for a while I led the life of a cripple. So therefore I was in hospital for quite a long time, and I didn't return to my home actually till I was 8 years of age. I then went to a school. I lived in High Street, Bow then, and I went to a school in Bow Row in High Street. One, which is at one end, was called High Street School, the elementary school. And when I was older, I went to a school at the other end, which was called Old Palace, being called Old Palace because it was the site of one of Henry VIII's palaces. Not there now, I'm afraid. It was taken bomb during the war, and the school's not there anymore. So that was my schooling, actually. And at the age of 14, of course, I got a job in Fleet Street as a messenger. I worked for the Starmer Group of newspapers, who actually owned the Westminster Gazette. And I was with them for 2 years. But unfortunately, one of the things that happened in those days, having started work at 14, which was in 1933, they used to only have you until you were 16, because at 16 they had to pay your health stamp. So therefore, you were put off. I've only been out of work for 6 weeks in my life, so I was out of work for 6 weeks. And then I went to work for Wholesale Haberdashers in Wood Street in the City of London, near off of London Wall. And from there, of course, I progressed, and I went to work as a kitchen hand at Lloyd's of London, which is the underwriting at Lloyd's of London. And I worked in their kitchen from the time I was sort of 16 and a half until I was called up for the army at 20 and a half. I actually worked as a kitchen hand, but I was told to look and learn, and which I did, and when I left there, I was their grill cook. Then I went, of course, for my interview for the army, which was in December of 1939. Of course, people had to register on their 20th birthday. Conscription had come in 1938. And I went to the drill hall in Romford, in London Road, Romford, and I had my medical and so forth. But I was actually categorised as A2 feet because of this injury to my left leg. They did ask me what I wanted to go in, and I did say that I wanted to go into the Royal Army Service Corps. This being the fact that I've always wanted to drive. And some of my friends had already gone in the service corps and were learning to drive. But I swear to this day that the man behind the behind the desk must have been deaf, because he put me in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I went to Aldershot on the 15th of January 1940 to be enlisted in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I did 6 weeks training, which was mostly drills, square training and so forth. We called it square bashing. And then from there I went on, we were given various grades of what we could be doing, what we couldn't do. And of course, when we were taken into a room where there were all sorts of charts which said, well, would you like to be a radiographer, a surgical nurse, all sorts of various trades that they have in the Royal Army Medical Corps. But of course, I was doomed to the fact that I was a cook. And in fact, I suppose I was one of the few few square pegs in a square hole, because I became a hospital cook class 2. So after about 10 weeks or 8 weeks, I think it must have been about 8 weeks, they had an outbreak of German measles in Aldershot. And so my first assignment then was to go to Aldershot and cook for the people that were in the isolation. I then was sent back after that was finished to the barracks, and I was posted then to a place called Redlinch in near Salisbury, and I was now a part of the 2nd Light Field Ambulance in the 1st Armoured Div. Now, this part of the history is that the we didn't know what was happening at the time, but apparently Churchill had decided that he would send another army to France to help to keep, to bolster up the morale of the French. And so he sent the 51st Highland Div, the 52nd Lowland Div, and the 1st Armoured Div, which at the time was the only armoured division that we had. He also sent a Canadian division. Now, what happened here was that we landed at Cherbourg, and it was a matter of going around the country at high speed, not staying anywhere too long. And of course, one never knew what I was there for. I didn't find out why I was there until after the war. Of course, the 51st Highland Division was captured at St. Valerie and taken prisoners of war. The 52nd apparently only had one brigade fighting. The 1st Armoured Division lost half of their armour at Calais, at the defence of Calais. And I don't know what really happened to the Canadian Division, but I know that most of us, like the 52nd at least, and the what was left of the 1st Armoured Division and the Canadian Division came out. And I certainly came out from France, from Cherbourg, on the 19th of June, which was my 21st birthday.
Were there any incidents or happenings that you can recount that happened to you in France?
Well, no, I think the point was that we were being pushed here, there and everywhere, and not... Well, I can remember, of course, that whilst we were going up, the French were coming back. And one incident was that we were actually dive-bombed by a German aeroplane and the civilians all scattered and rescattered. And, of course, I survived that, which was rather terrific. Horrific as well, if I may say so. And that was about the only incidents I can remember. We came back to Southampton, and that night we stayed in a school. And then that was the first air raid we ever experienced, because Southampton was bombed that night.
Was it easy to escape from Cherbourg?
Oh, yes, I found it quite easy. I mean, I can remember that it was a very bright, sunny day, and the sea was quite calm, actually. It was very uneventful. As I say, we had our first bombing raid on Southampton that night.
What was that like?
Well, a bit horrific, because, I mean, it was the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that. They didn't do too much damage. I think it was only a few planes, because actually the Germans had only just taken over some of the aerodromes, which allowed them to actually fly across the channel.
Where were you when the bombs were dropping?
Oh, we were in a school, actually, in a place called, I can't think of the name of the place, but we were billeted in a school at the time. But we left there the next day, and we were all sent on leave after a while. And from my leave, we went with them to Warminster, which is in Wiltshire. And we were there for a little while, camping out under canvas. And then, of course, the division actually reassembled, and we were stationed around Surrey. I was at a place called Holmwood St Mary's. It was a riding school. We were there for quite some time, actually. I know that we were stationed in the indoor riding school, and one of the occasions it was turned into a theatre because Enter had started to entertain the troops, and they gave a concert in there. I have to try and remember. Well, Doris Hare, you've heard of Doris Hare?
Yes.
Well, Doris Hare was one of the people on the bill, and or a few other people. I've got the information somewhere, but it's not on my top of my head. It's not there at the moment. But then later on, of course, I was posted again, and I ended up at a place in Suffolk, on the edge of Suffolk and Essex, a place called Haverhill. And to my astonishment, when I got out at the station, I found I'd been posted to the 52nd Lowland Div, whose sign, of course, was the 77 as a part of there, and St Andrew's Cross crest. Of course, the last time I'd seen this, of course, was in Cherbourg, when all their vehicles, as with lots of our vehicles, were left behind. Here I must say that, of course, if Hitler had decided to invade us at that period, I'm afraid we would have been a goner, because we didn't have anything. We'd lost most of the armoured division, we'd lost quite a bit of... We'd lost the 52nd stuff at Cherbourg, and we'd lost the 51st. So we didn't have very much. However, we only stayed around that part of the country for a while, and then we all were posted. The whole of the 52nd then went back up to Scotland. And we went to a place in Creath. We were in Creath, and I suppose we were there for about 18 months. We then moved to Musselburgh, where we were stationed on the race course. And from Musselburgh, we were sent up to a place called Old Erne, which is near Nairn. Nairn is known, it's not far away from Inverness. Nairn is known as the Brighton of the North. And we were there for quite a period. And then they then decided that we would be trained as a mountain div. And this culminated in the fact that we had to go under canvas in the Cairngorms. And we had Indians come over with mules. And of course we had to learn how to pack things in hampers so that they could go each side of the mules. And I actually climbed Ben McDewey with the unit. It was quite expensive to kit out a mountain div, because if you think about the period of time, we had double sleeping bags which cost £10 a piece, and I remember that our mountain climbing boots, which were made of pigskin, were £5 a piece. Of course, it was a lot of money in those days. However, I was then by that time, of course, in the Royal Army Medical Corps, everybody was, our officers were always full lieutenants, and the only non-medical commissioned officer was a quartermaster, and he would probably have been come up from being an RSM and given the rank of captain. But in 1943, they decided that they would form the catering corps. Up to then, of course, I was one of the only few trained cooks in the unit. The rest of them were all volunteers. And, of course, the fact that it had been a territorial unit, we had all sorts of people from Glasgow, like Glasgow tram drivers and things like that, who wanted to be, they were the cooks. So the fact that they formed the Royal Army, the Army Catering Corps, and at that time also it took a different direction for the RAMC, because they now decided that they would have other non-commissioned officers other than doctors. So we had what they were called stretcher bearer officers, and they came in as second lieutenants. This opened various ways of people being promoted in the RAMC other than being doctors. And but of course the thing was that having Army Catering Corps, the colonel wasn't allowed to keep me, although he wanted to. And so then I was then upgraded as A1. Up to then I'd been A2 feet. But I was posted then to the 20th Field Dressing Station, which at the time was stationed at, well, would be informed at Tunbridge Wells. Now, by this time, of course, I've been in Scotland for about 3 years. And we then actually formed the unit at Tunbridge Wells. And about 3 weeks later, I found myself on an advance party sitting on Motherwell's racecourse. And so for the rest of the period, we were in Scotland. We went to up north a bit more. We did our exercises, landing from the barges on the beaches around Forres and places like that. And various other exercises, we were brought down to Dover to do an exercise, mainly to time how long things would go and how long things would be and how long it would take you to get on the barges and so forth. And we were stationed at that time then at Ayr, which is on the coast of Scotland. We were then on the golf course. I then was taken ill with varicose veins, so I had to go into a hospital, which was Turnberry. Turnberry was a big hotel run by the LMS at those days. It's now a very, very well-known golf course hotel. And Turnberry isn't far from here. And I went in there, had my operation. But because I had been trained, it meant that I had to return to my own unit. In the main, very often if people went into hospital, they went to a holding unit and then probably finished up in another unit entirely different to the one they'd already been in. But however, I was then billeted at Southend for a while, which is the nearest I'd ever come from home, been home. And I then got back to Ayr. And of course, we were then sent down to the south of England, and we were under canvas behind barbed wire for about 3 weeks or so. But while we were there, of course, there were some huge marquees with these all the plans of for the invasion laid out in front of you. You didn't know where we were going, because they had various code names. But you were told in your briefing that when you landed, you would make your way to X, you see. Now, we went across from... the place just outside Brighton, I can't think of the name now.
Worthing?
No, it wasn't Worthing.
Newhaven?
New Haven, yes, we went from New Haven. We went from New Haven on an infantry landing craft, which is the one with the two ramps each side. They were ramp each side. The crossing was very, very violent, because we were down below, of course, and most of us were seasick, feeling very poorly by the time. We landed on the Queen Beach of Sword Beach, because the beaches were divided up into different sections. And we came ashore very near Lyon-sur-Mer. Fortunately for us, the landing craft got really high up on the beach, so I actually didn't get my feet wet. The only thing was that the ramp that I was coming down had been twisted, so we needed some sort of help to get off. I was carrying a stretcher, well, with another cook, I was carrying one end of a stretcher and he was carrying the other end. And we were helped by a young man who we later found out came from one of the American boats further up, because the Americans took some part in the landing at Sword Beach as well. I think they used some of their boats to bring people in. So he was an American sailor, and he helped us down. Now, we had been told that we were not to pick anybody up on the beach. It wasn't our job. We had a section of the field dressing station on the beach, and they were up against the groin of the beach, and they were there for something like 48 hours, actually. We then made our way to the spot marked X, but our commanding officer, Major Davis, wasn't very happy with the fact that we'd been earmarked at this place, because it was between a place that had been earmarked as a petrol depot and also an ammunition dump. So we then took ourselves off to another site that he found, and we set the field dressing station up. The actual place that we set up against is actually near, adjacent to Hermanville Cemetery. And in fact, they were actually digging the graves well through there. I can remember the first getting off the boat and walking up the beach. It's all very, very noisy. You kept having to duck your head every now and again. And we didn't lose anybody, thank goodness. We had four surgeons working all the time, so we had four operating theatres going. As a hospital cook, I suppose, I was a dietitian, but of course what we were taking in was a very, very bad stomach cases in the main, very bad operations to be performed. And of course it meant that we had to retain our patients a bit longer than normal, so that when they were fit enough, we could get them back to a field hospital, and a field hospital, they would be transferred back to England. We had several people who brought in who actually died. I think I can remember that we had three military policemen brought in who were all dead. They had been actually doing traffic duties at a crossroads in Hermanville, and had been shot by a sniper from Hermanville Church, from the tower of the church. He was flushed out later. But that was our first three that arrived in, and they were people we knew, because they were the military policemen who had been guarding the camp when we were in, I think we were in a place called Waterlooville, if I remember the name. We were in a place called near Waterlooville in Hampshire, and they had been guarding the camp, so we knew them, which was very unfortunate. Well, it meant, of course, that we had to stay there. It wasn't till later on I found that where we were, Lyon-sur-Mer, and near Lyon-sur-Mer, is that there was still a gap between the two beaches, which was a gap for at least 24 hours, where the German Panzer Division nearly pushed through. But fortunately, they didn't get through. And later on, of course, after having been in Hermanville for about 3 weeks, we then were sent to a place called La Deliberandi, and we set up a camp and hospital sort of affair there. And of course we had dug ourselves in, because we all had to dig our own little slit trenches. We lived in slit trenches. And of course when the breakout came, which was August the 20th, we then started to get on the move. And we started to move, and we took over a place, it was a nunnery. We all seem to take over nunneries. We took over a nunnery in a place called Lillibon, and we had quite a few people coming in there. We set up a small hospital with the operating theatre, and we were there for about 2 or 3 weeks. We weren't very far from Le Havre, which, as you know, we bypassed after a while. Then we moved up, and we were then going into Belgium. Supplies were getting a bit scarce, and we were moving up, and we actually moved up and found ourselves one very cold, misty morning in a place called La Boselle, which, and La Boselle is where one of the biggest craters in the world is, which went from the First World War, which was very bleak. And we were there for a couple of days waiting for our supplies to come up. And as you know, everything had to come from the Mulberry Harbours, because though we had captured some ports, they weren't intact for us to use. We then moved into Belgium, and we took over what actually had been some sort of asylum. I've forgotten the name of the place now. And we were there till just over Christmas of 1940. We celebrated, we had Christmas there. In fact, we entertained the youngsters of the village because things had dulled down. I mean, by that time we'd captured Brussels and places like that. And the things had died down for us. And we celebrated, the Belgians don't have Father Christmas, they have St. Nicholas and his little black boy. So the eldest man in the unit became St. Nicholas, and the smallest of our lads became the black boy. And we entertained the local children.
Where was this?
I've got the name of the place now. It was some sort of mental home. I've got it somewhere in my memories here, somewhere in my memorabilia. And then later on, of course, we moved to a place called Oosmal, and we were stationed in the castle there. We were there again for a little while, and things had hotted up with the fact that with the Ardennes, of course, so we were taking a few people in. And we were in Oosmal for a while. And then we moved up into Belgium, and we moved up into Belgium to Antwerp, and of course we were in Antwerp for a while, and then we got on the move again, and we moved into Germany, and we were in a place called Capellen. We took over another nunnery, and of course by this time things had died down quite a lot. Montgomery, of course, had got a bit upset about fraternisation, and unfortunately also he also sent out something on VD, because while we were not getting any surgical patients or anything like that, we actually were taking in a lot of people with VD, and they had to be treated with penicillin, so we had quite a few cases of those. It was very, very rife, actually, and that's why Monty actually got a bit worried about that.
Did the penicillin work?
Well, they were pumping thousands and thousands of units in them, so I hope it did. I should think it did, anyway. But don't forget, penicillin was in its infancy. And then later on, of course, we settled down in this place. May the 8th came, and the war was at an end. I think we all got drunk, what little beer we had, and about I think it was in the end of June, I was posted back to England. This is because, as a lot of other people were posted back from Germany and places like that, they'd gone all the whole way, they were posted back to England because we had promised the people, well, the British government had promised the people in Burma and India and the Far East, they would be the first to be released. And that applied to the people in Malta as well, because they'd all been there 4 or 5 years, they'd never seen their home. So I was sent back to the depot, which was at Crookham. And whilst I was there, of course, the atom bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. And at the end of September, I was posted to Malta, and I was at a place called Rabat, where our hospital was above that. And it was the 99th General Hospital. And of course, I was there for 10 months. I must say, I didn't like Malta very much.
What was the problem?
I found them to be lazy, the Maltese to be very, very lazy. Because we had their equivalents of. They had their own sort of regiments of artillery and RAMC and so forth. They belonged to the sort of units of Malta with that name. There were too many cooks there, actually, so I was